The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand or portfolio so easy it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly and our Facebook at 10 special. I'm Alex Kratosky here in France, and in the studio in London we have the tech team. Please, tech team, introduce yourselves in an orderly fashion.
Charles Arthur.
And Jemima Kish.
Samuel Gibbs.
And Alex Hearn.
Look at that. It's almost like we're professionals. So, Facebook, as the myth says, it all began with some lines of code on a window in a student hall at Harvard. It was born out of the competitive fraternity culture to rate the hotties from the naughties. Facebook, 10 years down the line, is now a highly profitable global giant with as many users as people in India, and still a lot of hot or not. So how did global domination happen? And where next? Stick with us on Tech Weekly from The Guardian for analysis and discussion. Joining us down the line is Professor John Naughton, Observer columnist and the author of From Gutenberg to Zuckerberg, What You Really Need to Know About the Internet. John, it's always a pleasure. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
In last Sunday's Observer Tech Monthly, you wrote quite a provocative piece on the first decade of Facebook, and you actually suggested that it's in danger of swallowing the whole of the World Wide Web. Why do you say that?
Well, I think that it's not just Facebook. This technology has some very interesting properties, and one of them, as you know, is that of network effects. And Facebook is a good example of a network effect in the sense that the value of it comes from Robert Metcalfe's famous law, which says that the value of a network increases as the square of the number of nodes. And what that means in practice is that a bigger network is more attractive because in some ways it's more useful to anybody who's come in to join it. And Facebook, and in that circumstance, in the online world, organizations which run networks which are very large can wind up in a situation where they capture the whole of the market, as it were, because once they get to a certain size, the difficulty of starting a competitor, you know, means that you might wind up with a winner take all situation. And I think that's intrinsic in the technology, and it's intrinsic in online phenomena, and there's always a danger that it will happen. And it's not just Facebook; it's also true with Google, and we saw it once happen with Microsoft a long time ago. So that's the problem, I think.
One of the interesting things about network effects, though, is how quickly they can devolve, how quickly they can lose their relevance and their value. If, for example, the key nodes, the key players, organizations, or whatever it is in the network disappear or stop existing, if those things no longer connect different parts of a network, then suddenly that network becomes useless. Is that something that could potentially happen to a service like Facebook?
Yes, it could. And you're right that just as network effects mean that things can grow very quickly, they could mean that things unravel very quickly too. And we saw that happen with MySpace actually not so long ago. And my guess is that's why anybody who runs one of these businesses, whether it's Facebook or Google or MySpace, or that the only rational philosophy for them is what Andy Grove used to say, which is that only the paranoid survive. Because somewhere you have this feeling that there's somebody cooking up something that will unravel my network, so to speak. And of course, I think it could happen. On the other hand, there's a certain kind of inertia built into this. And you could imagine a moment in which so much of the world is say using Facebook, that the chances of it being dislodged and unraveling become the probability gets smaller as time goes on. I think. I mean, just think about it, Alex. Facebook has now more users, well, at least as many users as India has people. It's used by 71% of online adults in the United States. That's 57% of all American adults. And astonishingly, for example, I discovered that 45% of U.S. adults over the age of 65 use Facebook. So these are kind of extraordinary figures, really, and doubly extraordinary when you think that the thing didn't exist 10 years ago.
So it's not the way that Facebook itself has sort of littered its way across the web. you know, through placing likes in certain places on different websites or like buttons, or the fact that Facebook is now used for identity validation. I suppose you could argue that those are sort of the paranoid the implementations of Zuckerberg's and Facebook's paranoia by keeping it relevant and making sure that their network remains valid and valuable. So I suppose that's quite a good example. But what you're talking about is ultimately, it's not that that's taking over the web. In fact, you quote Tim Berners-Lee, the inventor of the World Wide Web. You say that in conversation, you were surprised that people didn't realize the difference between the web and the internet. And he responded by saying there are hundreds of millions of people in the world today who think that Facebook is the internet. Why do you think that's a problem, or he thinks that's a problem?
Well, I think it's a problem because it means that people are confusing one application that runs on the internet with the internet itself. And the reason that's important is because the network is the key factor in all of this. The reason the internet is so special is that it is the first time we ever had in history, I think, where we had what one Stanford scholar calls an architecture for facilitating permissionless innovation. And that's why we had this explosion of innovation around the internet, because the internet says, if you can do something with data packets, then I'll do it for you. And I won't ask any questions, and you don't have to ask any permission. And what's interesting and in some ways sinister about this is that if you take the early years of the internet, and you have, say, somebody like Tim Berners-Lee, who has a great idea, and he eventually implements it using the internet. And that's a very good example of permissionless innovation. And out of that comes the World Wide Web. But in Tim's case, he decided that the World Wide Web should be an open platform. It should not be proprietary, it should not be controlled, it should not be restricted. And then along on the basis of the web, you have another explosive wave of creativity and innovation, one of which was Facebook. So Facebook is what you might call a second-order surprise, the web being the first-order surprise, and then Facebook becomes the second-order surprise. But of course, the interesting thing about Facebook is that it's not like the web. In other words, nobody's going to build anything on top of Facebook without Mr. Zuckerberg's approval, as it were. So suddenly you have a platform that was open to new kinds of innovation, and now you have a platform built on that called Facebook, which is not open to all kinds of innovation. It's stuff that has to be somehow controlled and approved by the company that controls the network.
Where did it all come from, this online social networking lark? Jemima Kish, give us a clue. What was the online world like in 2004?
Well, it's pretty difficult to remember that far back, isn't it? But most of us were sort of dabbling with bulletin boards. Some of us would have been trying out fairly nascent online games like World of Warcraft, which, while definitely not a social network, were very much a community of sort of like-minded people. So the foundations were there. And then over the next couple of years, from 2002, there was a flurry of the very first social networks as we might recognise them now. Friendster launched in 2002, and then 2003 was Hi5, LinkedIn, and MySpace. Friendster was the first social network that I remember finding, and it's still quite popular in Asia with about 90 million users, which seems quite random, but Friends Reunited, which amusingly I wrote in my notes as Fiends Reunited, had a very sort of patchy history. But I think for mainstream consumers, that was the social network that they really first started dabbling with and started being able to sort of see if friends that they knew were on there. And obviously it was UK-centric. Alex is looking at me as if I've just eaten a sheep.
I'm just remembering in awe that...
You're vegetarian, Jemima.
Yeah,
that would have been surprising.
Exactly.
I'm remembering in awe that Friends Reunited managed to operate a paid-for business model. They charged for membership.
Yeah, yeah, they did eventually. They did. And then they
charged for connectivity. They charged for you to send a message to someone. I mean, anyone could be a member.
Yeah.
But in order to communicate communicate with someone privately to say, hey, you know, should we get together? We used to be in the sixth form, whatever.
Well, they were hugely successful when they peaked. And then I think they got bought by ITV and they got sat on and their developers were treated like rubbish, which, as we know from Facebook, is sort of the key to success, to look after your developers and your engineers.
Allegedly, of course.
Well, not allegedly. Actually, very definitely Facebook really, really is a company. Perhaps even the first, perhaps even more than Google, it's a company where engineering culture is absolutely right at the top of the hierarchy of that business, not just in the product that they do, but in the way that they work, to great effect, evidently.
What was the dominant social network when Facebook really started to kick
off? It was very, very much MySpace. I remember going to a gig back in the days when I could do that kind of thing, and on the back of the toilet doors where all the graffiti was, there was MySpace scratched into the door with myspace.com/bandname. It seems crazy now because it's just become a byword for sort of disastrous internet companies of our time, but it was really hot and it was exciting because it was a space not quite like GeoCities, but it was a space where you could create your own little place on the internet. You could customize it. You could get your hands dirty with a bit of fairly basic code. And you could make your space sort of an online representation of what you were interested in. And people really enjoyed it. It was massively popular.
And yet we shifted from something that was infinitely personalizable to something that was basically a template system. It was something that, you know, was only black on white, blue on white, and white on blue. Basically, that was the color scheme of Facebook.
Yeah.
And you couldn't do anything with it. And not only that, but you also had to use your wallet name, your offline name. Why did that work for Facebook? And actually, here's a question. Does it still work for Facebook?
I think people were quite skeptical of Facebook initially because it felt quite sterile and because there wasn't the same level of customization. But at the same time, that made it seem much sleeker and more effective in a way. Obviously, clearly the biggest benefit for people using their real names is that if you're trying to build a network of people that you know, you need to be able to search and find them. And to do that, you either have to have an intimate knowledge of the handles that your friends use online, or you need to just be able to enter their real names. Of course, for Facebook, not coincidentally, that meant that using people's real names, you therefore had more meaningful representations of those people online, which for their advertising profiles means that that information is much more lucrative because you know where they are, who they are, what their interests are, their age, and all of that very rich information that Facebook has managed to build a business around very effectively.
Thank you very much, Jemima. And you can read more on Jemima's analysis of the impact of Facebook in this week's Guardian newspaper, this week's Observer Tech Monthly, and on theguardian.com/technology. It's been 10 years since Facebook launched in a dorm room at Harvard University. Charles Arthur, our resident numbers man, has the details on how its teenage founder went from eating tins of beans and ramen to becoming one of the richest men in the world. Charles, tell me a bit about Facebook's business growth and whether he still eats ramen.
I don't know whether he still eats ramen, I have to say, though he's not a vegetarian, so he probably eats anything he feels like. But in the past year or so, they've gone from $1.3 billion in revenue, that's at the end of 2012, the fourth quarter, to $2.3 billion in the fourth quarter of 2013. And the more interesting thing, I think, is that of that, the money that they've been getting from desktop users has stayed pretty much level. It's gone from about $1 billion to nearly $1.1 billion. But the revenue they got from mobile users has shot up $305 million in the last quarter of 2012, up to $1.2 billion in the last quarter of 2013. So that mobile is now a bigger money spinner for them than the desktop. And that's actually reflected in the way that people use Facebook now. So that it used to be all desktop, obviously. You know, having started in 2004, that's the time when, you know, you really didn't have anything in the way of smartphones. But as time has gone on, since the sort of end of 2010, the number of people who've been using it just on the desktop has actually dwindled. So at that time, they had, in the beginning of 2011, they had 680 million users every month. Of those, about 500 million were only using it on the desktop, and about 188 million were using it on mobile and desktop. Now, the number who've been using it only on the desktop has gone from 492 million back at the start of 2011 to 285 million at the end of 2013. And that's out of 1.23 billion people. So the number of people who are using it on mobile as well is now 945 million. But here's a really interesting thing, which is that the number of people who are using it only on their mobiles, that is, the only way they actually go to Facebook is via the mobile, 296 million. That's more than the number who are only on the desktop. So there's a big shift. As the mobile web grows, Facebook is growing as well on the mobile web. And I think that it's actually testament to how well they've configured themselves, how well they've moved the times, that they've been able to make that move from the desktop onto mobile so that they're actually bigger in mobile, both in users and in revenues, than they were on the desktop. A lot of companies haven't been able to make that sort of shift.
So that's where the future money is coming in. Let's have a look at the past. Let's look back to 2004 and then up until the IPO. What was their secret sauce then? What did they sell to the potential investors, and what really clinched them the biggest deals?
Well, the thing that Facebook has always had, the way that it's always offered itself, is to advertisers, we've got a lot of people from all across the social spectrum, all sorts of people, all sorts of little niches you might want to find. So if you want to find people who are married, who live in Milwaukee, who have, I don't know, cats, and who also drive a Chevrolet, then we can put the adverts you want to put in front of them. It doesn't sell the data to the advertisers, but the advertisers can pick people who they want. And it's interesting because you can start to mine Facebook in this way by looking at how many people it has available. And you can say, okay, so how many married women in Milwaukee have iPhones, or how many single men in Wisconsin have Android phones, and that sort of thing. And you can begin to actually build up a picture of the world like that. If you really want to segment it out, then, you know, Facebook will let you. And for advertisers who want to put their messages in front of particular niches, then it's really valuable.
They've managed to ride the wave of several controversies specifically to do with privacy, whether it was the launch of the news feed, which people thought was an early warning sign about what they were going to be doing with our data and how much they were going to be sort of sharing that data amongst the public, to much more recent things about, you know, Mark Zuckerberg arguing that privacy is dead, and then, of course, changing their privacy settings and changing them back so that there is not as much control over privacy as there has been in the past. Have issues about privacy caused any financial dips? Have controversies had any positive or negative effects?
There's no sign of that at all in their numbers, either their revenue numbers or indeed in their membership numbers. And I think you'd have to mine the numbers really carefully to be able to see any effect from that. And I think it would be hidden in all the noise of the growth in other countries. So there's been some suggestions that teens aren't using Facebook as much. To be honest, that doesn't seem to be borne out by the statistics. Teens seem to be using it just as much, and they're actually more active users of Facebook than many other age groups. So I don't see any effect from the whole privacy thing. It's interesting because, you know, what we were just talking about, it's so interesting if you were to count how many last straws there have been for privacy on Facebook. You know, you'd have a lot of straw. I think that it's one of those things where some people get upset about it, and I think in particular countries it's probably a bigger issue. I mean, Germany is much more insistent about privacy than other countries, but, you know, it just doesn't seem to make any difference to the Facebook juggernaut. It just keeps on going, and privacy keeps on being melted away like a sort of polar ice cap.
Where does their money go? If we look at other incredibly large internet companies, for example, Google has been buying up small companies left, right, and center. And, you know, their intentions are pretty clear when you look at the types of companies that they're buying, whether it's drones or artificial intelligence. You know, there's a whole host of really interesting companies that they're buying. Where does Facebook's money go? Do we have any indication of where they're heading based upon their acquisitions or what they're developing in-house?
Well, the biggest acquisition they're best known for is Instagram for $1 billion. And the thing about that was it was a mobile-only company. It was about sharing stuff, and it was about pictures, which they weren't strong in any of those departments. And it's made bids, or at least offers, for Snapchat, again, a mobile-only company, about about pictures, about sharing. So the that's one way in which they're focused. They're trying to think about things which are mobile, which are almost standalone apps. It's sort of splintering its attempts to get in front of people by being lots of different apps on the same device, so that you might go to Facebook Messages as an app, and you might go to Instagram as an app, and then you might go somewhere else as an app. You know, Facebook Paper is most recent one that's been launched, because it's trying to suggest that you don't have to be in Facebook to be using Facebook. But the other place that their money goes is on data centers and stuff. You know, just investing in getting bigger.
The apps thing is really interesting, Alex, because this is part of a new strategy for Facebook. They've launched Paper, as Charles said, which is it's actually separate to the news feed, which was different to what it first appeared to be. So these are entirely separate news stories, some of them created and promoted by editors and some of them created by and shared by users. But that's just one example of how they're sort of chopping and dicing Facebook's content differently. And to start thinking about what they might do with that in a commercial environment, they could, for example, have a Facebook travel app, as we were talking about earlier. So you take all the travel content from Facebook and then you line it up with travel brands. Or you could have a Facebook galleries and museums app or a motoring app. And those are huge, really powerful, very, very lucrative markets. And Facebook is sitting on, kind of live, incredibly demographically rich information about users, and being able to bring those together with brands at the same time. If we think they're making a lot of money now and the market cap is at $158 billion, I think, this morning, we've possibly only just seen the start of it.
I hope, Jemima, you're getting some cash money for those suggestions, because you know what? They're pretty good. Charles, thank you so much. There's more on Facebook's financials and possible futures at theguardian.com/technology. Let's go back. Let's go way back. And let's talk with Alex Hearn, because, nowadays everybody uses Facebook, right? Well, 10 years ago, Alex, as you've been finding, that social graph was pretty sparse. Who was on the Facebook when it first started?
Well, somewhat unsurprisingly, it was mostly people from Harvard. In fact, it was entirely people from Harvard. It was only open to people from Harvard University. The earliest members were even less varied than that. They were largely other techies, the same sort of clan as Zuckerberg and Dustin Moskovitz, the two sort of tech co-founders of the site. If you can today still go to facebook.com/ and then type a digit in, and for the most part, what you'll get for the first 100,000 digits you type in are the rough order with which Harvard students joined it. So facebook.com/4 is Mark Zuckerberg, /5 is Chris Hughes, and /6 is Dustin Moskovitz, the three co-founders who at least still stayed on with Facebook. Eduardo Saverin, the little talked about fourth co-founder, or at least little talked about until The Social Network came out, is actually, his ID number is 41. He joined much, much later than a few other people who...
Andrew McCullum,
who designed Facebook's first logo, a sort of weird blue and white pixelated version of Al Pacino. His ID number is 26.
Good knowledge.
Very
good. You're coming to my pub quiz. That's awesome. But Alex, where are these people now? Are many of the initial people who were on the Facebook, were they part of the Facebook community? Were they part of the team and are now rolling around in their millions? Or were they just, interesting Harvard students who went on to do interesting things?
Well, so Andrew McCullum's a good example. He was so early that he sort of couldn't help to be drawn into the business side of it. So he made the first logo for the site. He currently works at a venture capital firm where his title is Entrepreneur in Residence. I have no idea what that means.
It basically means I was one of the first Facebook dudes, and that pays his way around town.
But then you also get people like Ari Hazit, who was a non-founder. He was Zuckerberg's roommate at the time. He now is a student rabbi in Israel working for a Jewish youth group called Noam. So there are, it's Harvard University. There's a huge variance in the sort of jobs that people go into. They all tend to be vaguely proficient in whichever career they're in. But then, of course,
they went to Harvard, you know what I mean?
Exactly.
Clever kids anyway.
But they're going to find it hard to compete with Zuckerberg or, say, Chris Hughes, who is basically the 21st century's Citizen Kane.
Is this not a good juncture at which to say how outrageously underestimated was Mark Zuckerberg? And actually, I think a lot of the stereotypes about geeks, and even to an extent Aaron Sorkin's film, sort of dismissed him as like a geeky coder.
But I think the thing is that we've seen so many people come and go. There have been, loads of companies, lots of networks, lots of, great startups who go, yeah, okay, that's pretty promising. But they don't stay the course. So MySpace is a fairly good example in that respect. You see it even within Google, where Orkut was a social network that came ahead of Facebook, and they managed to mess that one up fairly badly.
Yeah, it's the way
They bought a Twitter clone as well at Google, managed not to do anything with that. And for quite a while, Jaiku. Twitter looked as though Twitter for a while looked as though it wouldn't survive, and it went through a few changes of CEO itself. So
it's the way he's managed to morph the business, actually, because when it started, it was a fairly sort of straightforward networking tool for a university, not even multiple universities, and he somehow managed to transition what seemed like a very, very niche idea, and a lot of services for colleges are sort of dismissed a bit. He managed to change that not just into a social platform for anybody, but one where suddenly multimedia was central to it, and then obviously more recently he turned it into a mobile first proposition. It's quite incredible that he's managed to do that.
One of the things that was raised by John Naughton, whom we interviewed earlier in the podcast, in his article last week about Facebook and how it's potentially taking over the entire internet, is that he said we cannot underestimate the technological and the technical prowess of the early coders, because as soon as it went large, they were able to cope, whereas other social networks might not have been able to cope when they hit scale and when they just exploded. Facebook or the Facebook or, whichever iteration it was, perhaps that's actually, when it comes down to it, the reason why it was so successful, is because they were able to meet the demands of a generation of internet users who had very high expectations for their software.
That's absolutely right. When I spoke to Saul Klein about this, the VC, he made exactly this point, that the sheer achievement of engineering at that scale is quite astonishing. Sorry, Charles.
No, it's totally true. I mean, that for example, is what where Google succeeded. Google was always super focused on getting your results back to you quickly. And that was the only thing that Larry Page and Sergey Brin used to focus on, was how quickly can we get the search results back to people? And they built so that they could scale and they could do that. And Facebook has done the same. It's been able to connect you, get the information traveling around, and stay robust. So the times when Facebook used to go down, there have been hardly any. And when they did happen, it was quite dramatic.
You could read more on the profiles of the first folks at Facebook at theguardian.com/technology. Now, finally, if you've had enough of this technological wonder of the world and you're thinking about leaving Facebook because, it's too populated by your parents, or you're wondering if you should join up for the very first time because you're sure you're missing out, Samuel Gibbs has first-person experience in eschewing the social network, even for a short time. Samuel, you took a hiatus. You took a social network break. Why did you do that?
Honestly, it all got a bit too much. One of my problems with Facebook at that time was that I had around about 300 so-called friends on the network, and their updates, their tagging, their photos, that basically everything they did was fired at me via emails, via notifications. It was an endless stream of prompting to come back to this website that didn't really interest me in the first place, and it just ended up being kind of like a rat run of popularity. If I posted something and it didn't get 12 likes, it was a disappointment. Where had I gone wrong? What was I doing wrong?
I think you're taking it a bit seriously, Sam. It was just a bit of fun.
Hey, it's not fun. This is life. This is your popularity challenge.
Okay.
There was definitely a bias overall towards the perfect self-image. Everybody was posting the perfect image, their perfect success, everything that was great, and everybody was having an amazing life. And you looked at your own life and you thought, hang on a minute, it's not that good. I mean, really, why am I not winning this?
This is the inherent problem of Facebook, though, isn't it? That everybody on it is doing very particular sort of selective self-representation. And all of those people have highs and lows in their life, and they're sort of not really allowed to talk about the lows because you don't really do that on Facebook because it's a like button, not a sympathise button.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, it all just got a bit too much, if I'm honest.
So you took a break. What did your friends say?
Well, the first was the realization that nobody actually realized that I had left. That was the funny thing. Well, because
if a tree falls in a forest,
absolutely devastating.
I didn't deactivate my account or do anything like that. I literally just kind of shut off all notifications, put up a quick post that said that's enough. I'm out of here. But that didn't stop the torrent of interactions with me. Everybody just assumed I was there, and their responses when they finally found out that I had kind of taken this break was like, why would you want to do that? What could you possibly gain from leaving Facebook? Well, time for one, but personal worth? I'm not sure. Anyway, it all got a bit sticky, if I'm honest, because at one point I was down to play a rather crucial role in a stag do, which was basically driving out of London, and I was designated driver. The stag was a friend of mine. The best man wasn't. I didn't know him from a bar of soap, and he just assumed because I was on Facebook that I'd seen everything and everything to do with the stag do. He invited me, set me down as designated driver, and then the first I knew of it was a panicked phone call going, "Where are you? Where the hell are you? You're meant to be here with your car fully stocked. Drive us out of London for 70 miles. What are you doing?" It's like, oh, right, okay. Yeah, I didn't get that.
Thankfully, other social networks and other services are available online, so we mustn't throw out the baby with the bathwater. But before we go, I wanted to quickly go around the table and ask everybody, starting with you, Samuel, will we be celebrating 20 years of Facebook?
I have a feeling Facebook as we know it won't exist, but there will be something like Facebook interconnecting all of us. And I think that thing's called the internet in another 10 years.
Alex, what do you think?
Prompted by Sam's piece, I actually deleted my Facebook account today, so hey! I won't.
Deleted or deactivated?
It's like an AA meeting.
Deleted.
You
deleted.
Wrote them the letter.
I left a little message saying, I'll be deleting my account. Here's my email address. Find me on Twitter, which I actually use. Left it a while, and now the account is gone.
Just like that.
Fully deleted.
He was gone.
Charles, what do you think? Are we all going to be like Alex and deleting our accounts, or will we be around on Facebook in 20 years' time?
Well, there's lots of people still on AOL, and I think that's pretty close to 20 years. You know, it's
really.
Yeah,
who's still using
AOL? There are still people who are on dial-up from AOL. So, and that's, you know, certainly 20 years old. It's got people probably who used to have CompuServe accounts, and CompuServe goes back at least to 1991 or so. So, yes, I'd say, yeah, Facebook is going to be around. As Sam says, you know, it's a bit uncertain quite what form it'll have, because the mobile web is going to be trampling all over what we think of now as the web. But yeah, it'll be there.
And Jemima, we'll end with you. What do you think? Will you be here celebrating 20 years of Facebook?
I don't know if I'll be celebrating it. I'll probably be mulling it. But I'm really impressed on sort of looking back over these 10 years. It's just really sort of made an impression on me that actually we did really underestimate Mark Zuckerberg. So I think Facebook will be around. I think it will probably still be pretty relevant. And I think the form it will take is completely beyond any kind of prediction we can make.
Well, I presume that, like every 10-year-old's birthday party, Facebook's employees now have a tummy ache from too much cake and have all fallen out over who actually won the piñata. We hope so. Thanks to all the team in London. Remember, for more analysis and insight about Facebook and so much more, go to theguardian.com/technology. But for me, Alex Kratosky, and Tech Weekly producer Jason Phipps, we'll be back next Wednesday. Thanks for listening. Bye.
So Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag and drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today. No credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code Guardian.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.